Thanks for having me on.
It's a very dramatic title, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's supposed to be a bit melodramatic, but not entirely untrue. So I think people will hopefully read it and engage and realise that I'm actually reporting from various places what is going on, often behind the headlines. So
you have travelled extensively for this book, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, and indeed around Australia. What were you looking for?
One of the things that was important to me was to recognise, and I guess I thought about this years ago, but the ideas took a while to percolate through into a more robust book, was the corporations become more powerful than the state. And I'm not the first one to say that, but I think what's happened in the last 30 years, particularly since the Thatcher-Reagan years, and Australia often has a trickle-down approach to world views and economics, is that in bipartisan ways, whether it's Labor or Liberal here or the US or the UK, regardless of who's in power, there's a sense somehow that private industry, private corporations run things more efficiently, so to speak, and in a way that we should trust better. So, for example, I went to look at the reality of private wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. A lot of people don't realise, perhaps, that post 9/11, the US-led wars in Iraq, Afghanistan and elsewhere are run by the US military or the Australian military. However, a vast amount of work is done by private corporations, often without tenders. So you have a massive number of corporations in the US and here and elsewhere that are winning contracts. Some of them could be as mundane as preparing food for soldiers. Some of them could be as much as private militias that the US is using almost as a proxy force to kill supposed enemies. And this is without little or no accountability. And I think people want to know that and should know that, and there should be some greater awareness of it, because essentially, if we go to war, and we seem to do that a lot in this country, we should be aware of actually who we're fighting, why we're fighting, and the kind of people we're using to fight.
So, Anthony, are you suggesting that these conflicts are continuing because there is money to be made by private companies?
That's definitely part of it. One of the things you find, particularly in the US, and there's no doubt that our political system here, obviously, we're in the middle of an election campaign. Money is obviously a factor here. You know, the argument of a journalist is always follow the money. But the difference, I guess, in the US is that money has, in my view, and many people's view, so fundamentally corrupted the system where the ability for private corporations or individuals to assist political campaigns of congressmen or women. The effect of that is in many of these districts, defense lobbyists and private contractors are giving money. Mostly it's not illegal, it's actually legal, which makes it more of the problem. But the reality is that when you have congressional reports, which come out all the time, and I detail some of those in my book, and you find certain corporations, the most famous, infamous would be Blackwater, Halliburton and others, human rights abuses, appalling, and yet it has little or no effect on them getting more contracts. And that's happening similarly in Australia as well. And that's happening with, say, detention centres here, which I guess we'll get to. So I guess what I am saying is that not money is not solely fueling the war in Afghanistan. It's sort of ideological and political. But the financial aspect is certainly important. And I think people often ignore that and forget it because the press doesn't often report it that well.
When or why do you think there was a shift between the power of the corporation and the power of the state?
There's not one particular event, but what started happening in the 70s, and this particularly was coming from in the 80s from the US and the UK, Reagan, Thatcher and others, was a belief that the role of the state should be reduced. There was a sense and a belief, and it was articulated for many years, that the state had become bloated, public service was bloated, that it was important that public service was reduced in a range of areas, and the private sector was more efficient, did a better job, was cheaper, and would serve the public better. The reality, however, in many, many areas that I talk about, private prisons, private detention centres, private aid, the resource industry, war, is that the bottom line financially is not the only thing one should be looking at when we're talking about the most vulnerable people in society. Are there examples where private companies can do a so-called more efficient job? Of course there are, yes. But ultimately, the areas I'm looking at are areas where I and many other people believe it's incredibly unhealthy to have a private corporation whose modus operandi obviously is the bottom line. Doesn't mean the staff, all the staff who work for, say, Serco, the British multinational that runs our detention centres, are all evil people. Of course, they're not. But what you do find is that the corporation itself routinely spends the least amount of money it needs to on, for example, mental health workers for refugees or staff. And the effect of that is that the conditions in the detention centres are worse. And I think the change has happened where it's become a sort of bipartisan sort of article of faith where for a politician to come out and say the state should massively expand is not seen as very sexy. The Greens, to their credit, generally do talk about that. But in the major politics of Australia and most of the West, they don't. I think that sort of thing has left massive holes in providing adequate services for many vulnerable people in our society.
And is that example that you've used there with detention centres, is that how you would define vulture capitalism?
I would. One of the things that's happened, and this started during the Howard years, it continued under the Labor years, whether it was Rudd or Gillard, now back Rudd again, is following the model in the US and the UK where detention centres for asylum seekers and prisons are outsourced to corporations. And the records of these corporations, whether it's G4S, Serco, CCA, a number of corporations some listeners may have heard of, and some might not, but their records in terms of their ability to manage contracts well, to treat people humanely, both staff and detainees, is appalling. And this is not my own view. This is countless reports from the US Congress or the British Parliament or the Australian Parliament. And one of the things that is disturbing is most people aren't aware that Serco, as one example, a British multinational, has contracts with the Australian government now of more than $1.86 billion. And they manage the detention centres on the mainland and Christmas Island. G4S, another British multinational, runs the one in Manus Island. And as you said in your introduction, regardless of who wins the election in a few weeks, Abbott or Rudd, it seems almost guaranteed that that centre in Manus Island will be expanded in some way and corporations will benefit from that. So my position and what I'm arguing and exposing in the book is not to say that every corporation is evil. Of course not. What I'm saying is that when the state makes a choice to outsource things like detention centres, often in the most remote places, and I spent time in Curtin in WA and Christmas Island, and you see the kind of militarised language that is used by staff towards asylum seekers, and the result of that is a massive deficit of care. I have a in the book a leading senior Serco whistleblower who still works for the company, who gave me a lot of internal documents and gave me an interesting insight into the kind of culture within Serco. It's incredibly, any journalist listening will know that to get information from a corporation like Serco is close to impossible. And the relationship between Serco and the immigration department and the government, regardless of who's in power in Canberra, is deliberately difficult. And the result of that is that it's very difficult for a citizen such as myself or anybody to get accurate information what's happening inside the centres and the ways in which Serco and G4S are not treating both asylum seekers well and, more importantly, are deliberately not, for example, hiring more staff when there's a surge in boats, as there has been in the last 6-12 months. And that, I think, is deeply problematic and should alarm many people.
Anthony Lowenstein is my guest. His book is called Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. He's travelled extensively to write this book across a number of different countries, including Papua New Guinea, Haiti, Pakistan, Afghanistan and Australia, and looking at the balance of power between business and government in the modern world. Anthony, you have a look at mining companies as well, and your suggestion is that they really take advantage of land in developing countries. Can you give us one example?
I can. I spent time in Bougainville, which is in Papua New Guinea. It's a province in that country. And there was a Rio Tinto-run mine there until the late 80s. And in short, there was this massive, crazy, very violent civil war for about 10 years that killed roughly 15,000 Bougainvillians. This is a war between Rio Tinto, the Papua New Guinea government, the Australian government, and really the Bougainvillian people as insurgents, so to speak, who were incensed by the fact that the Rio Tinto mine had both caused massive human rights abuses and caused incredible environmental destruction and pollution in the area. The mine has been shut for 25 years, give or take. And what's happening at the moment is that, and this is one of the things I think that people are not aware of, is one of the problems I think with Australian aid, and for the listeners who aren't aware, Papua New Guinea receives over $500 million of aid every year. And there's very mixed views about what that aid does. Is it beneficial? Is it not? A lot of people I spoke to argued that the aid should be massively reduced or stopped. And of course, there's different views to that and alternative views. The problem is that often the aid in these countries is actually going to, for example, consultants through AusAid, the Australian arm of our aid and development, who are assisting a Bougainville government to write mining laws that will then actually allow Rio Tinto to return. And the problem with that is that the local people in Bougainville, many of whom I spent time with, are saying, where's compensation for what happened to us years ago? Where is any sense that environmental destruction will be reversed or fixed up? And in countless examples, Papua New Guinea, Mongolia, a range of areas and a range of companies, the rhetoric that mining companies often give is wonderful. We'll provide schools and education and roads and opportunity. And that sounds fantastic because the governments themselves often don't do that. But the reality in so many of these countries and areas is exactly the opposite of that. It's a militarization of a space, and only a handful of locals do receive benefits. So I guess what I'm arguing is that in so many countries, when Australia is now using our aid program to promote views that says mining is the answer, we have a new mining program through the Australian government, which basically goes around the world saying to developing countries, we can give you Australian assistance to benefit your local communities. The problem is that the examples that we are using to show supposed success, in fact, are the opposite of that. And I think in a place like Bougainville, where a company like Rio Tinto, a massive, massive mining multinational, caused so much destruction, and to the point where a lot of former Rio staff themselves talked about the kind of complicity with human rights abuses back in the day, the idea that that company should be able to return without the true acceptance of a local people, because they're often paying off local officials, this is all being documented, it's not me just making this up, I think is a worry. And the Australian government, I think, and the population need to be, I guess, more aware and alive to what often our aid is doing. Our aid is not just helping poor kids or poor women. It does that, yes, but often it does other things that are far more pernicious.
So who should be responsible for the work conditions, the business deals done when you are working in perhaps a third world country with a multinational business, and you've got other countries like Australia as kind of third parties involved in the deal as well? Where does the responsibility lie?
Look, it's a difficult question. And one of the things I talk about in the book, and I looked into this in great detail in a range of countries, is that the problem often lies with the fact that the country of origin of the corporation, Australia, America or elsewhere, rarely if ever imposes any kind of rules and regulations about how that company should behave in a third country. Obviously, when a company like Rio Tinto operates in PNG, they're operating under PNG law. That's the way it should be. But the problem is when you have an Australian aid program, for example, which has, and WikiLeaks documents a few years ago showed this in detail, has enriched and brought profound corruption to a PNG political elite. Are we giving money as an Australian people or Australian government with our own tax dollars as a way to make ourselves feel better? Are we actually helping the Papua New Guinea people? And of course, one of the problems is that, and many PNGers were saying to me and many others were saying to me as well, that too much of our aid money is actually going back to something called boomerang aid. People may have heard this expression, where we're paying local or, more importantly, international, like Australian consultants, massive salaries to go in there and tell people how to behave and act. And the problem with that is that a lot of the money, therefore, doesn't stay in the country or country itself. It comes back here. And this is a huge problem in many countries. I found this in Haiti as well, where the US government gives countless amounts of money to Haiti every year. But actually, it's not going to the Haitian people, because the results on the ground, as I saw, were devastating. Actually, it's going to US consultants who are earning a fortune to go to a country like Haiti and tell them what to do. And the problem with that is, and this is definitely a race problem, when you have a lot of white consultants going to a black country saying, you know, this is the way you guys should operate. This opens up, not surprisingly, issues about colonialism and imperialism and how the outsider is telling us as black people how to behave. I'm not saying for a second that a consultant from Sydney or Brisbane doesn't have the right to do important work in PNG, for example. Of course they do. The problem is that too much of our aid is given to individuals like that who are going there, and the money itself is not actually going to the people there. It's actually coming back here. And the knowledge is not often taught to locals, and this is what I saw in Haiti as well, where individuals are often saying, the West gives all this aid, all this supposed development, but when these Westerners leave, what exactly is remaining? You know, you haven't really trained us. You haven't really trained us. You haven't brought local development. That sort of thing is a real problem.
Anthony, you talk about in that example, disaster profiteers, aid leeches. I mean, it's pretty provocative language. Are you talking about extreme examples here? Or I'm just wondering if you know, if the head of various aid agencies that have been in overseas countries for long terms would be saying to you, hey, hang on a second, we've done a lot of good work.
I'm sure they would. And I'm not saying at all, and I explain this in the book, that there aren't NGOs and aid groups doing wonderful essential work. There was an earthquake, for example, in Haiti in January 2010. The country was devastated, particularly around the capital, Port-au-Prince. And there's no doubt that the NGOs and aid groups that came in there to do work did vitally important work to assist individuals who were dying in huge numbers. Absolutely. I guess what I'm saying is that there's too many of us who live in the West who don't really think that much about where aid and development money is going. It's almost like we outsource our morality to NGOs who say to us, we are doing important work in PNG, Haiti, Afghanistan. And of course some are, but how much accountability actually is coming to them? To that organisation itself. We shouldn't also forget that some NGOs are for-profit. I mean, not that they all are, but many are. And that sort of thing obviously changes the dynamic as well for how they view supporting a community. And one of the problems you have in, for example, Afghanistan, and I spoke to a range of Afghans and Westerners who have been there for a long time, is that we being the West, since we've invaded there in 2001, so much money in apparently supporting building the country up. The reality, though, in fact, on the ground is that we're actually leaving incredibly little. And what I mean by that is that we've spent so much money enriching in that country an Afghan political elite so corrupt, where you drive around Kabul, as an example, there are, after 12 years of an occupation, virtually little or no good infrastructure for locals. Outside Kabul, it's even worse. And I guess my point is that, not to demonise all aid groups, absolutely not. It's to say that they're doing wonderful work, but to actually bring more accountability and questions, which they often don't like, I might add, about their work. And that to me is an important thing. If we actually want to believe, for most of us who can't or don't want to go to these kind of countries or areas, don't we want to have faith that the work they're doing is important? And often you see, for example, after the tsunami in Asia in 2004, a lot of reports that came out, which didn't get as much press as the tsunami itself, of course, of massive mismanagement of funds. And there are some NGOs that, for example, will stop taking money. MSF is one, Médecins Sans Frontières, that will say after a disaster or some horrible event, that we don't need any more money. We actually have enough money to manage issue X, as opposed to keeping on taking more money to be used for who knows what and who knows where. That kind of accountability, I think, is important to restore faith in the communities out there that those groups are doing good work. And I think also to say that these corporations, and often they are corporations, should be held accountable. They're not elected by any of us, but they do very important work and they shouldn't feel like they're beyond scrutiny.
Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. That is the title of Anthony Lowenstein's new book. He's looking at mining companies, privatised detention centres and non-government organisations as well, and asking some questions that will make several people feel a little uncomfortable. Anthony, did you find an answer to the question as to who should have more power in the world, business or government?
Yeah, I think no one can say they have the answers, and neither do I. I haven't got all the answers at all. So let me just say that straight out. But one of the things I do investigate and find, and throughout the book I try to explain that, I'm also working on a film about disaster capitalism as well, and looking at the question of bringing far more accountability to the organisations that are working in some of these countries, for one. Secondly, far greater pressure on these organisations that are working in, say, Afghanistan, PNG and elsewhere, to much better engage with local communities and train local communities rather than simply instructing them how to behave. And this happens time and time and time again.
And do you think that's a role that government can fulfil?
I do. And I think one of the things when it comes to, for example, Australian aid, when there is a lot of talk at the moment about what the aid budget, where that will go after the election, whether it's Labor or Liberal, the Liberals have talked about cutting it a bit. The Labor Party in the last few years have cut it a bit because they're spending so much money on managing their asylum seeker issue. I think there needs to be far greater transparency about where the money is going. And also, as I said to you, the question of consultants, where there is so much money being spent on Western Australian and others consultants who are making a fortune. And the question is that work being assessed well? Are we actually getting value for our money? And this, after all, is the tax dollars, and we have a responsibility and right to know where that money goes. And far too often, if you speak to people very honestly, mostly off the record, about where they think this sort of money is going, they will say to you that a lot of it is going to waste, a lot of it is disappearing, and that sort of thing I think is a problem.
Anthony, really great to talk to you tonight. Plenty of food for thought. I don't know how well some people will be able to swallow this, but yeah, it's
hopefully well.
Yeah, definitely worth chewing over. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.